Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Tom Campbell, the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business, University of California at Berkeley, and I'm the moderator for this program. Today's program is part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. It's being held in association with the New California Network. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today we'll be dealing with the budget. It's a very appropriate topic as this morning's news carried the story that the national debt is now in excess of $9 trillion. We've set a new record. 57% increase in the national debt over the administration of the current president. The numbers of years that it would take to pay back the amount of money currently owed, just the amount of money currently owed, not the unfunded liabilities, at the rate that the United States has been, is in excess of 300 years. I'm also privileged to have been the finance director of the state of California, and the comparable number for the state of California is slightly over 80 years. But our focus today is on the national front. We're featuring panelists affiliated with a project called the Fiscal Wake Up Tour. It's a joint public initiative by the Concord Coalition, which I think you know is a national nonpartisan organization advocating fiscal responsibility, and the Budgeting for National Priorities Project at the Brookings Institution and the Heritage Foundation. Purpose of this tour is to explain in plain terms why budget analysts of all sorts of perspectives are increasingly alarmed at the nation's long-term fiscal outlook. Although the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, is projecting that the annual budget deficit will be declining this year for the third time in a row to $158 billion, our panelists today are here to talk about what they believe is an unsustainable long-term fiscal outlook, projecting a 10-year baseline deficit of $5.10 trillion. Members of the Fiscal Wake Up Tour may not necessarily agree on the ideal level of spending or of taxes or of debt, but they do come together on the following points. One, we can't solve this problem by announcing that we are going to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. You can't just talk your way out of the problem. Second, that the best way to make the hard choices is a bipartisan process that does not exclude any option. And third, that public engagement and understanding are vital to find solutions. Our speakers today also are united in pointing out that this is not just a fiscal problem, it is a moral problem from the point of view particularly of the intergenerational transfers that we take from our children. The panelists, David Walker, Comptroller General of the United States. Mr. Walker became the seventh Comptroller General of the United States, a 15-year term on November 9, 1988. He is a CPA and has a certificate in management from the Kennedy School. Dr. Bell Sawhill, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Sawhill was Associate Director in the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, in the administration of President Clinton. She holds her PhD from New York University's Graduate School of Business. I pause to emphasize that her degree is in a business school. This is a good thing and should be encouraged. Dr. Sawhill is the mother of Jamie Sawhill, a PhD candidate in the business school at the University of California at Berkeley, at the Haas School, where I'm dean. Allison Fraser. Allison is the director of the Thomas Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. One of the Rowe Institute's priorities is the reform of the entitlement programs. Robert Bixby, executive director of the Concord Coalition. Concord Coalition has organized this tour, so we owe them all a debt of gratitude for putting all of the strategic and tactical aspects together to make this a success. The coalition itself was founded in 1992 by former Senators Warren Rudman and the late Paul Tsongas. The panelists have asked that we go in the following order, that Robert Bixby will start off on the subject of why we need to focus on these issues, that Dave Walker will speak next on the long-term challenges, Bell Sawhill on why this debt matters and possible solutions, and Allison Fraser then on the choices that we face. Let's now begin with Mr. Bixby.
Thank you very much, and thank you everybody for coming today. The first thing that I want to do is assure all of you that none of us are running for president. After you hear what we have to say, you will probably understand why. But a lot of people who are running for president will be coming through California looking for your votes, and that gives you a special responsibility, and we know it's one that you take seriously. So we're here not for your votes, but to try to persuade you that one of the key criteria in assessing the seriousness of presidential candidates or candidates at any of the federal levels is whether they appreciate the magnitude of the challenges that are coming up, the need for trade-offs, and the advantages of acting sooner rather than later. Now, if you've been following the federal budget closely, as I'm sure you all have, you might have heard some good news. For the third year in a row, revenues have been up and the deficit has come down. So you might ask, why are we traveling around the country issuing a fiscal wake-up call? Well, the reason is simply that we're not looking in the rearview mirror. We're focused on what's coming ahead. And it doesn't take a crystal ball to see that we've got some problems on the horizon. Our nation is undergoing a dramatic demographic transformation to an older society. And we're doing that against the backdrop of steadily rising health care costs and steadily falling national savings. That is a very dangerous combination for the future health of the economy. Let me just throw out three facts to consider. To sort of tee up the discussion. First, on the current budget situation, the three biggest federal entitlement programs are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They comprise 42% of the federal budget. That is before the baby boomers begin to retire, which won't begin to happen until next year. Think about that, by the way. The first baby boomer is going to cash a Social Security early retirement check next year. So those little kids running around in coonskin caps are about to retire. And I was one of them. So, second key fact is demographics. Over the next 25 years, the number of people, percentage of the population age 65 and over, is projected to go from about 12% where it is today to over 20%. That obviously is going to put increased pressure on the three programs that I mentioned, which are already 42% of the federal budget. Now, if you add on to that the third factor, which is rising health care costs, then things get really problematic because health care costs have traditionally risen faster than economic growth. So every year they take up more of the budget and more percentage of the economy. And if you look at health care costs and say, gee, what if health care costs continue to grow at the same rate over the next 40 years as they have over the past 40 years, where would we be? Well, at that point, just two programs in the federal budget, Medicare and Medicaid, would take up as much of our nation's resources as the entire federal budget does today. That is about 20% of the economy, or 20% of GDP, as the economists like to say. And other speakers will pick up where we're going, but obviously changing course is going to require some very difficult choices on programs that people really care about and on federal taxes, which people obviously really care about. So that means that the American people need to be a vital part of this conversation on where we go, and that's why those of us on this fiscal wake-up tour are going around the country. We often show a picture of Paul Revere on our travels because he really symbolizes what we're trying to do, which is spread an alarm. We're not preaching gloom and doom. Far from it. We have faith in the American people, and we have faith in elected leaders. that if they understand the facts, they will address the key problems in advance of a crisis. But in order to do that, we need to spread the alarm and get people to understand it. We don't, as was alluded to, we don't all agree on the right solutions. We come from different perspectives. And that's, what I think, what makes the message so powerful, because we can agree whether you're left, right, liberal, Democrat, Republican, conservative, independent, whatever you want to say. The numbers just don't add up. And so ultimately it becomes a matter of arithmetic and not a matter of ideology. And we all on the panel agree on that. I think it's important to focus, too, on the fact that there really aren't quick-fix solutions to this. We all get outraged by waste, fraud, and abuse stories that we read about in the paper, and we all think economic growth is a great thing, and it is, and we want to keep the economy growing strong over the long term. But relying on waste, fraud, and abuse or a booming economy is not going to get us out of this problem. It is going to require a bipartisan solution, bipartisan cooperation, a willingness to put everything on the table. And it's also important to remember that this really isn't about numbers. Fundamentally, it is a moral issue. It's about the legacy that we want to leave to future generations. That's what we're deciding now. What kind of a structure are we building for future generations to live in? Right now, the structure is unsound. It's our job now, as generational stewards, to fix that problem.
Thank you. Dave Walker.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in San Francisco, one of the world's most beautiful cities. You know, we live in a great country. In the United States, we have much to be proud of. We have much to be thankful for. We're number one in many things, but not all things. But we face a range of very serious sustainability challenges. Fiscal, health care, energy, the environment, education, immigration, and Iraq, just to name a few. Our current path is unsustainable. We're here to talk about the fiscal challenge, which overarches everything, and as you all know, bad news flows downhill. So if the federal government has a fiscal problem, that's going to affect state and local governments, it's going to affect the independent sector, and it's ultimately going to affect American families. You know, the budget composition has changed dramatically over the last 40 years. 40 years ago, 43% of the federal budget was for defense, and only 1% was for Medicare and Medicaid. Last year, 20% was for defense, and 19% was for Medicare and Medicaid. 40 years ago, the Congress got to decide how two-thirds of the budget would be spent. Last year, it was 38%. Stated differently, 62% of the budget was on autopilot. That cannot continue. By the way, of that 38%, a vast majority of that is what the federal government is supposed to be doing under the Constitution. National defense, homeland security, judicial system, Congress, foreign policy, Treasury, Executive Office of the President. Those are all in discretionary spending and are being squeezed more and more. You know, short-term deficits have come down, and some people think, well, gee, the problem is Iraq and Afghanistan and the global war on terrorism. That's why we're running deficits. That's not true. Last year, we spent about $100 billion in Iraq. That obviously doesn't help. But our operating cash deficit was $434 billion. So we could get out of Iraq tomorrow, and it's not going to come close to solving our problem. And, in fact, we haven't yet faced the tsunami of spending, which is the retirement of the baby boom generation and related escalating health care costs, that will start next year and will build over time. In the last 6 years alone, the nation's total liabilities and unfunded commitments for Social Security and Medicare, the difference between what we've promised and the dedicated payroll taxes and premiums that we have to deliver on those promises have increased from $20 trillion to $50 trillion in 6 years. Of the $50 trillion, $32 trillion is Medicare, $6.4 trillion is Social Security, and $8 trillion of the $32 trillion is the new Medicare prescription drug bill. $50 trillion is $440,000 per American household. Median household income in America is less than $50,000 a year. Therefore, on our current path, each American household has an implicit burden mortgage of $440,000, but no house to back the mortgage. And it's growing faster than net worth of Americans. You know, state and local governments have their own problem. This is not just a federal problem. GAO issued a report within the last year that showed, probably last month, that shows that within the next 10 years, state and local governments are going to start facing escalating deficits primarily due to four reasons. Number one, Medicaid cost. Number two, underfunded pension plans. Number three, unfunded retiree health obligations for state and local workers. And number four, additional infrastructure needs and deferred maintenance on infrastructure, bridges, streets, water sewer systems, et cetera. So this is really a national problem. It's not just a federal problem, although the federal problem is, you know, as the dean mentioned, Dean Campbell mentioned, is greater. But, you know, he talked about 300 and some odd years for the current debt. That's the good news, because the tsunami of spending is about ready to hit our shores, and yet we're still partying on rather than getting serious. We've got to educate the public. We've got to make sure that the first three words in the Constitution come alive. We the people. We the people are responsible and accountable for what elected officials do or do not do. They've been dancing too long. It's time to start working. We need to start making tough choices sooner rather than later, because time working against us, the longer we wait, the bigger the change is going to have to be, the less transition time that we have to make it. We've got to improve transparency as to where we are, where we're headed, reimpose tough budget controls, tougher than we had in the 90s, that took us from deficits to surpluses. They've all expired. Reform Social Security, health care, our tax system, and reexamine, reprioritize, and reengineer the base of government, because most of government's based on the 1940s, the 1970s, and a lot of it just flat doesn't work. And some of them aren't as high a priorities as they used to be. The sooner the better, for the reasons I articulated. It's not just about numbers. I can give you a lot of big and bad numbers. It's really about values. How about the word stewardship? As stewards, we have a responsibility not just to leave things better off when we left them, when we leave them when we came, but better positioned for the future. Furthermore, it's about people. And for me, it's about my three grandchildren. They're going to pay the price. They're going to bear the burden if elected officials don't act. They're too young to vote. They don't have a voice, and so I'm their voice. In summary, this nation has four deficits: a budget deficit, a balance of payments deficit, a savings deficit, and the worst of all, a leadership deficit. And that crosses sectors, and it also is a bipartisan problem. We need to get serious soon, and we need to recognize the reality that if we want our future to be better than our past, we need to start making some tough choices. So if we want to keep America great, we need to make those first three words in the Constitution come alive: we the people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bell Sawhill.
As you can hear, Dave Walker doesn't have any passion about this at all. Let me elaborate on the question of why deficits matter and why we all need to be concerned. Basically, four reasons. The first has already been talked about. It's Dave's three grandchildren and all the other younger generation. The second is exploding interest on the debt, $227 billion every year just for interest on the debt. That's about $1,000 of your taxes that's being earmarked just for interest, and it's the fastest-growing part of the budget by far. Third, our increasing dependence on foreigners. We're basically consuming more than we're producing. We're borrowing the difference from abroad. They could withdraw their support at any time, and that would be a huge problem. Fourth, we have a missed opportunity here to invest in the future. If you think that the nation's future depends not only on the amount of debt that we're accumulating, but also on the kind of investments we make now in education, in health care, in transportation, in telecommunications, and other kinds of infrastructure to help us stay competitive, then this lack of resources is doing double damage to the future. So what are the solutions? First of all, Social Security reform. Three quick points about that. The average American is going to spend one-third of their adult years in retirement. We can no longer afford that. We could back in the 1930s. We can't in the 21st century. We need to raise the retirement age. Secondly, most Americans are taking early retirement. Almost three out of every four Americans retire before the age of 65. That may surprise you. We need to encourage people to work longer. Third, Social Security was never meant to be more than just one leg of a three-legged stool. The other legs were to be employer pensions and individual savings. We need to encourage more individual savings. As Dave said, we have a savings deficit. One way to do that would be to have to require personal accounts on top of Social Security. And that's an idea that bears further discussion. Health reform. When we talk about this fiscal tsunami that's coming, it's all about health care. That's the big driver here. The problem is not just Medicaid and Medicare. It's the entire health care system. Those costs are affecting not only government budgets, but also employers and ordinary Americans. So this is a huge topic, and we can't go into it in any detail in the very brief time I have, but let me suggest the possible elements of a solution. One, a basic package of health care for everyone. I say basic, not Cadillac, Ford-type package. Second, much more emphasis on paying for performance, for what works to improve our health as opposed to an open-ended commitment to fund whatever consumers want. Third, more income relating of government benefits and perhaps a cap on total government expenditures to help us get serious about this. And fourth, much more emphasis on prevention and coordination of care. Finally, tax reform. Let me mention three options here that need to be discussed more. First of all, simplifying the system. That means eliminating or reforming existing deductions, credits, and other preferences. We spend $900 billion a year on what are called tax expenditures or these various preferences. It also means fixing the fact that we have two parallel tax systems right now, a regular income tax system and an alternative minimum tax. That needs to be fixed. Another option is not to extend all of the Bush tax cuts, particularly those that have gone to the most affluent amongst us. Analysis done at Brookings and elsewhere has shown rapidly growing inequality in U.S. society. The tax cuts didn't cause that inequality, but they are exacerbating it. Third, we could add a new tax to the system, maybe one that's more based on consumption than income. Every other advanced country except ours has a value-added tax, for example. Maybe a tax on energy. After all, we have, in addition to the problems you're hearing about from the panel today, a global warming problem, which is also a problem of what kind of legacy are we going to leave for the future. The nice thing about an energy tax is it would be a twofer. It would both deal with global warming and raise revenues for the federal government. So, what happens if we fail to act? We could have an economic crisis, and we can go into that. It would most likely happen because foreigners went on a strike against the dollar. But we may not have a crisis. This may not be a case of the wolf at the door. This may be a case of the termites in the woodwork. And those termites are going to reduce our standard of living in the future and weaken the nation in a way that may be quite invisible, very gradual, and in a sense, all the more dangerous for those reasons. Put differently, I believe there are going to have to be higher taxes and lower benefits in our future, and any presidential candidate who tells you otherwise doesn't deserve your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill Sawhill. Allison Fraser from Heritage.
Thanks a lot. I'm going to talk to you about the choices that we need to look at and examine as a nation. But before I do that, I just want to set a little bit of historical context, and that is that the United States has been historically a low-tax, low-spend, but very high-growth nation. That's one of our keys to our success. And these three programs that we've been talking about, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, are poised to change all of that as baby boomers begin to retire. Now, we all on the panel agree that there are no easy answers here, but we can sort of break down the choices into three categories. And I'm going to talk about those to help you understand the magnitude of the problem. Now, the first choice is for us to do nothing, to keep on spending, and us, of course, is Congress, not you and I, but to have Congress keep on spending and keep on borrowing. And if this were to happen, we would see deficits in the future as large, relatively speaking, as the entire federal budget today. And what would that mean if interest rates started to increase? Just a very, very minor increase in interest rates of like 1 basis point would literally cause spending to go off of the chart. We would really see a fiscal meltdown. That's why we're here to talk about it with you today. Now, no one is seriously proposing such a solution, but unless we have real substantive discussion by our leaders in Washington and our candidates, then that is the path that they're tacitly endorsing for us, and we can do better, and that's clearly unacceptable. So we've got two other choices here. The second choice is to look at the tax side. And let's just remember that historically taxes have been about 18.3% of the economy. That's right about where they are today. And if Congress were to solve this problem solely through taxes, we would see taxes climb from this 18% level to 30% of the economy over the coming decades. And that would pose real problems when it comes to, the future of our economy, for growth, for wages, for jobs, for opportunity. And just to give you a little bit of perspective, that's 2/3 higher than a burden we face today. And when you think about tax rates, all tax rates would have to triple, nearly triple, in order to make that. That's obviously not going to happen. No one's proposing it, but again, it gives you a feel for the magnitude of the problem. The third choice is spending. Now, because it's so politically difficult to talk about these three programs, I'm going to just set them aside. And as I do that, one of the things that I like to do is to return to the vision that the founding fathers had for this nation and for the federal government, and look to the functions that are constitutionally laid out. And those that aren't laid out in the Constitution, maybe we ought to think about eliminating them. These are just hypothetical illustrations to help you think about it. But I'm going to start with NASA. Now, I love space exploration. I think it's exciting, but it's not a function of the federal government. If we eliminated NASA tomorrow, that spending line, it would barely come down. So we've got to make other big choices. Let's add to NASA foreign aid. Let's add pork barrel spending. I think some of those are really good things to do. If you do them, the line comes down just a little bit more, but we still have huge fiscal imbalance ahead of us. In fact, if you were to eliminate the entire Department of Defense tomorrow, all of the Pentagon, all of our military services, and by the way, defense is a core constitutional function. If you were to eliminate it, it would not solve this problem over the long term. So it's clear that we can't nip and tuck around the margins. We really need to be tackling these tough problems of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Now, you've heard some solutions already talked about. By and large, I agree with most of them. But sort of my take on them is I have got four recommendations. The first thing is we need to change the way Congress spends your money. We need to have tough limits set that are unbreakable, and we need Congress to be able to have the tools to make priorities in an efficient way. We need to revisit the social insurance programs. As you've heard, they aren't sustainable. We need to protect today's retirees and those people who are close to retiring, but at the same time, modernize the programs so they meet the needs of future generations without undue burdens on them. We need to encourage personal retirement savings, both for savings and insurance and long-term care. And we do need to reform the tax code. Now, the way that I would go about it is a little different. I would make it certainly simpler. I would make it flatter. I would make it growth-oriented so we continue to have strong growth. And I would ensure that that whatever we do, we can remain with our taxes internationally competitive. And the last part of the solution is you. And by being here, you've indicated that you're really interested in this issue. But we can't have any solutions without discussion, not just in Washington, but here in San Francisco and across the country. So thank you so much for your interest. and look very forward to your questions.
Thanks to all four of our panelists, David Walker, Comptroller General of the United States, Belle Sawhill, Senior Fellow, Brookings Institution, Allison Fraser of the Heritage Foundation, and Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's subject is the federal budget deficit and its ramifications. My name is Tom Campbell. I'm the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business, UC Berkeley. Let's get right to our questions. I'm doing my best to summarize several questions when I lead off with the issue of illegal immigration. Is illegal immigration helping or hurting in the issues that you have discussed here today? And I'll put that question to Allison or Belle. I see them looking at each other. So, Allison, I'm choosing you.
Well, you know, immigration is certainly a very, very emotional issue, and we need to look at it at a couple fronts. I think one of the things we need to think about are what are the educational and skill levels of immigrants who are coming into the country. What are the possibilities for those immigrants to rise in terms of economic mobility? Are they going to become more educated? Are they going to become more skilled? And these are all important questions that we need to ask. When it does come down to these three programs, there's two things that I would have you think about. One is that there are already estimates for immigration that are built into these numbers that are, you know, basically widely accepted. Dave could maybe talk a little bit about how the trustees work in another question. But those estimates are already there. One of the things to think about also is that for illegal immigration, illegal immigrants don't qualify for these benefits. However, at the state and local level, and we're talking about federal programs here, at the state and local level, there are huge impacts on schools, on emergency rooms, and other kinds of infrastructure. Belle, you want to add to that?
No, I think you said it just right.
So then let me put to both of you and to the other panelists as well, can you give me a bottom line, net positive, net negative, illegal immigration, not all immigration, illegal immigration? Net positive, net negative. The reason why that conceivably one could say the positive is they pay taxes that go, the FICA tax that goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, but don't collect it.
I was going to say before you stressed illegal so much that they are a net benefit fiscally to the nation as a whole, but they can be a drain at the local level.
And is that your response to all immigration or to illegal?
I'm not sure, Tom.
Okay. And I'm pushing it only because that was the question that was asked. The focus was on illegal. Any other comment on this or we'll move along? Alrighty. A number of solutions from the audience. The gold standard. Robert, if you pardon me. Is the gold standard a serious alternative to which we should give consideration?
I would defer to other panel members. I don't think so. I mean, I think what we need to focus on is the mismatch that we have between promised future benefits and the resources we're setting aside to pay for them. And I don't think there's any magic solution out there other than that. I mean, we need to confront those hard choices, and they're a matter of policy choices.
I think one of the aspects that attracts people to the gold standard is its automatic curing of the balance of payments in international trade. If it was an absolutely strict gold standard at the end of the year, you would accumulate so much gold, or your trading partners would accumulate so much gold, and if you stuck to a certain ratio of dollars per gold, your dollar would depreciate if you lost gold and appreciate if it gained gold, and you would have no balance of payments problem after 1 year. So that leads me to a lead-in question that I might direct to Bob as well as Dave. Is there a balance of trade aspect to this that we should focus on? In other words, is the U.S. Fiscal crisis, to which you've devoted so much expertise and time, made worse by the trade imbalance as we are selling less and less and buying more and more of what other people produce? And I'll toss that one to Dave.
Well, first, America as a whole is consuming more than it's producing. And many Americans are spending more money than they make, following the bad example of their federal government, charging their credit cards, taking out home equity loans, and leveraging up their future, if you will. Yes, the balance of payments, the trade deficit is a subset of the balance of payments deficit, is a problem. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, quite frankly, is the dollars in the tank. The dollar has declined in value dramatically in the last year, and yet our trade balance really hasn't improved dramatically. Now, there's a lag indicator there, but still, we have a new paradigm. It's a new world. We're a superpower, and we're going to stay a superpower, but we're not going to be the only superpower in the world in the future. And I think while we'll have major influence, we're not going to be able to dictate and dominate world affairs, and we haven't come to that realization yet.
Would you say a fair comment is that as the trade imbalance, the balance of payments gets worse, the United States will have to pay a higher interest rate to attract foreigners to buy our debt, and so all of those aspects of the interest rate on the debt that is in our budget that Bell referred to become worse?
Yeah, I think there's no question that the biggest risk that we probably face is that foreign investors may decide that if we don't get our act together, or if they want to diversify in order to spread risk to the euro and other opportunities to invest, then we're going to pay higher interest rates, and then that will have a compounding effect.
Bell, you want to speak to this?
I was just going to point out that one of the reasons that the fiscal deficit hasn't gotten people's attention is because in the past, when the government ran large deficits, interest rates went up because the government was competing with the private sector for funds. And interest rates, long-term interest rates in particular, have stayed very low through this whole debt accumulation process. And the reason is because we're getting all this money from abroad. So this is part of the termites in the woodwork, and this is what's keeping the wolf from the door. And as Dave says, we don't know how long that will continue.
A former Treasury Secretary in his book made reference to a statement that he attributed to Dick Cheney, quote, "Deficits don't matter, Reagan proved that," end quote. And the analysis was based on the fact that we run up these deficits, but interest rates don't go up. So what's the problem? And you answered it in terms of termites. Is there anybody willing to see a wolf as opposed to a termite?
The other thing that needs to be said about it, if I may jump in here,
sure,
is that what people, I think, fail to understand is that even if interest rates aren't going up because we're borrowing from abroad, eventually we're going to have to pay that money back, and we're going to have to pay the interest, profits, dividends, et cetera, on the money we're getting from foreigners. So we are earmarking a chunk of our future economy, our future GDP, that's going to go to foreigners, and that's what's going to undermine our domestic standard of living.
Well, Allison,
if I could jump
Dave
in here, you know, I think that Bob touched on this a little bit earlier. I mean, we do have deficits right now that are very, very low. And the real concern that I have is that deficits, if we don't do anything, deficits are going to grow in this country to absolutely unprecedented levels. And we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we do know it's not going to be very good.
Allison, I take your point. And precisely because it's not so immediately severe, we might accumulate more of a problem than if the symptoms were immediately observable. That's my editorial comment on your answer. If you disagree, let me know. Otherwise, I'll move to Dave. Dave.
I think Vice President Cheney was talking politically. Politically, in the short term, they haven't mattered a lot. Economically, they clearly matter long term. And in fact, they can have an adverse effect on our national security if we undermine our economic growth. Now, frankly, the administration has changed on that. They now recognize the long-range imbalance does matter. They've talked about doing something about it, but frankly, they don't have the political capital to get anything done about it now. Second thing, don't forget that we're not just talking about the economic and fiscal implications of borrowing from foreigners, but what about the foreign policy implications? Remember what happened in 1957. The United States told England, you better not try to contest militarily Nasser is taking over the Suez Canal, because if you do, we won't continue to buy your debt, we won't prop up the pound. Arguably, England's our strongest ally. That should tell us something.
It was also the cause of the fall of the government in England when the United States took that position.
I just wanted to note on the deficits don't matter issue, we had touched on it, I think Bell did. Last year, we spent $227 billion on interest payments on that debt. That was 9% of the federal budget. It was more than twice or about twice what we spent on Iraq and Afghanistan. It was the same amount or more than we spent on the federal share of the Medicaid program. So if somebody tells you deficits don't matter, why are we paying $227 billion of taxpayers' dollars on that amount of money? Deficits do matter, and the problem is it's like an addiction. It's easy to get into, hard to get out of. And that's politically the real danger.
Closing off on this subject, I'd simply note that last year, for the first time in recent history, more than 50% of the debt was held by non-United States entities. So it's taken that time to hit that number, but now more than not is held by foreign holders. Getting back to the possible solutions, Graham Rudman Hollings, directing this one to Bob, should we bring it back or some other version of a automatic cuts in the event that Congress is not able to make the cuts, an automatic system does it for them?
I think it's absolutely essential to reimpose some tough budget controls. Whether it's not, it's Graham Rudman, I'm not sure that worked. What they did was revise it. That required automatic across-the-board cuts, which sometimes Congress didn't make. In fact, they never did make them. But then they decided to revise the format to something that worked a little bit better, which was a caps on discretionary annual appropriations programs plus a new rule called pay-as-you-go, which meant if you were going to increase an entitlement program or if you were going to cut taxes, you had to find some way to pay for it without making the deficit get worse. And what that did was force some very difficult trade-offs, which you'll remember as serving in the Congress at the time, and Bell remembers from serving in the Clinton administration, that required these tough trade-offs. And we're going to need to get back to that. Those rules, those statutes, did expire in 2002, just when the budget was going back into deficit. We need them back now, and whatever solutions are enacted, I would strongly recommend that they need to have some enforcement, tough enforcement mechanism with them, automatic controls that would enforce whatever the Congress agrees to.
Allison?
I absolutely agree with that. I think another thing that I'd like to see Congress really tackle is the way they evaluate these programs. Right now, there is no long-term evaluation of the cost of these obligations. So Dave gave you his $50 trillion number. That doesn't appear in the annual budgeting process. And I think one of the things that we should do is just the way businesses have to record what their obligations are, we need the federal budget to get a lot more active in showing those numbers, maybe making Congress take a tough vote if they're going to increase those numbers. And then the second thing is to evaluate any policy changes, not only over the short term, which is the way they do it now, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, sort of arbitrary time frames, but also over this long term, so we really understand what the context of policy changes are.
And Dave wants to speak.
I agree with what Bob and Allison said, but in addition to that, we need to put on the radar screen mandatory spending, both front door spending and also tax preferences. We can't give them a pass. When they get to be a certain size, we need to reconsider them. This country spends about $3 trillion a year, and it also foregoes revenues of $800 to $900 billion a year through tax preferences. They're not in the budget process. They're not part of the appropriations process. They're not in the financial statements. They're not subject to reexamination, reauthorization, and it's time they should be, because many of them aren't working, and some of them are benefiting different segments that may or may not should be benefited.
The last category of suggested solutions that the attendees have sent forward in their written comments is tax-related. Interestingly, some members of the audience have said, why don't we lower taxes in order to stimulate productivity and GDP growth, thereby growing a revenue base out of the deficit problem? And others have said, why don't we reimpose excise tax on luxury goods? And some have been very much more direct and said, why not just tax the wealthy? I'd like your comments, please, on the aspect of taxing as a solution. I'm going to start with Allison on this.
Here you can see where we don't all agree on exactly some of the solutions. You know, I really believe that it's necessary to keep taxes low, to keep the economy growing strong. I think there's, you've heard a lot of conversation about getting more revenue. I think there's different ways to get more revenue. And as I said in my remarks, I like to see taxes flatter. I like to see them simpler. I like to see them growth-oriented. In answer to your question, there's lots of ways to go about this revenue aspect. But remember, taxes are not just a bookkeeping entry. They do have real impact on the economy. And we need to bear in mind that we want to create a We want to create a future that's better off for our younger generations. That means giving them, you know, good possibilities for jobs, wages, you know, if they want to be entrepreneurial or whatever. I look for lower taxes on capital. I think it's extremely important for us to be economically competitive. I will say this, and I know I'm talking a little bit too long. You know, not all tax cuts are created equally. I think there are some tax cuts that have a lot of positive effect on the economy. I think there's others that have passed that have no impact on the economy. And so it's important to think about it in this context. You've heard a lot of talk in Washington about all tax cuts being free. That's not the case. And there are tax cuts that are much more beneficial to the economy.
Bell, do you agree with Allison in her analysis of the tax side?
I agree with a lot that she says, but we wouldn't come out in quite the same place. Let me, though, address a question that I think we do agree on, and that is this notion that if you reduce taxes, they might pay for themselves because they'd produce so much economic growth. This has been analyzed by many, many economists, including those who serve in the current Treasury Department, including Martin Feldstein, who was president of the CEA, chair of the CEA during the Reagan administration, and Greg Mankiw, who's now at Harvard but was chair of the CEA during the current Bush administration. All of those analyses show that if you finance a tax cut by borrowing, which is what we've done, of course, in other words, it's not been paid for, it is not going to increase economic growth. If you had a tax cut that was paid for by spending cuts, then you might get a small increase in economic growth and a little bit of revenue offset. But even the current Treasury Department's analysis of that suggests the revenue reflow from that would be at best about 10%. 90% would be revenue loss.
Let's move to another subject, but before we do, Dave had one last point, I think.
Yeah, real quickly. You want to keep taxes as low as possible in order to maximize economic growth, maximize disposable income, and maximize our competitive advantages compared to Europe and other major competing partners. But in the final analysis, you got to have enough revenue to pay your current bills and deliver on your future promises. We're short now. We're going to get a lot shorter. We're going to have to reform Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We're going to have to re-engineer spending. But we're not going to solve the problem at 18.3% of the economy. And it's a matter of how you go about restructuring taxes to accomplish those objectives.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Today's subject, the federal budget deficit and its ramifications. Panelists, David Walker, Comptroller General, Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution, Allison Fraser of the Heritage Foundation, and Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. My name is Tom Campbell. The next area is, are you sure you really want to solve this problem? We're right now looking at the possible beginning of a downturn. The signs of economic growth are certainly slower than they have been. And I'm summarizing several different questions now when I ask, if you withdraw the stimulative effect of the, you might call it Keynesian effect, of the federal government deficit, are you not condemning us to a sooner and deeper recession? And I'll start with Bob.
I think, again, you have to distinguish between short-term and long-term. What we're warning about is a long-term phenomenon that's not affected by the economic cycle for reasons that others have mentioned. We're not going to grow our way out of this, even with pro-growth policies in place. So it's always easy when there's a period of slow growth or it appears that there's a danger looming, a lag in the economy, there's always a danger of saying, well, we can't do anything about long-term fiscal policy because we might affect a recession. And then when things are going well, people say, oh, well, you can't do anything now because you might harm the good economy. Well, that means that you can't ever do anything about this problem. So I think we need to look beyond short-term solutions here. For example, doing something that was suggested, like gradually phasing in an increase in the Social Security eligibility age, or doing something about maybe better targeting Medicare premiums for targeted on income. Those things would have great long-term impact. They would not have a short-term impact. And we need to be thinking long-term here.
Another question picks up on this and suggests that maybe we can just last the crisis in Social Security because of the blip caused in the demographics of the baby boomers. So in seeing the numbers of heads shaking no, I don't see anybody.
I think you've got a unanimous
no.
I used to be a trustee of Social Security and Medicare, and the fact is this is a blip.
This is Dave Walker.
This is not a blip. We're going from 16 to 1, 16 people paying into Social Security for every person drawing benefits in 1950. Today, 3.3 to 1. We're going down to about 2 to 1, and it's going to stay at about 2 to 1. Because our birth rates are 2.1, that's replacement. The only reason our population is growing now is because of immigration, and it's basically, it plateaus at about 2 to 1.
When we deal with these problems, we compare ourselves with how other countries are dealing with the problems, and a number of questions have come in about whether Europe and Japan have a better grasp of these problems than we do. Certainly you've got an aging population in the Japanese demographics. Certainly you have some of these same issues of the social safety net in Europe. If there is a member of the panel who feels comfortable making some comparisons, a number of the audience would like to hear them. If not, we'll move on to another subject. Yes, please.
GAO has done work on this, and we're continuing to look at other countries to find out what lessons can we learn from them. I think the bottom line is there are a number of countries that have similar challenges that we do. There are a number of European countries that have worse demographic challenges than we do, for example. They have much higher tax levels than we have, and so they don't have as much flexibility on the revenue side. At the same point in time, many of those countries are ahead of us in reforming their health care programs, are ahead of us in reforming their pension programs, and we need to learn from their experience to determine what the right way forward is in America.
And this segues into a number of questions on the political process. What is it about these other countries that has allowed them to address these problems better than we have addressed them? If there's a comparative political scientist on the panel, is there something that these other democracies are doing that we should?
Well, for one thing, they're not superpowers. Number two, they don't have the world's reserve currency. Number three, many of them have parliamentary systems where the government and the parliament are one, in effect, and therefore, you have more of an ability to get people to make tough choices and get things through. And in some cases, they were on the verge of bankruptcy. New Zealand was on the verge of bankruptcy. So they had to do something, and they did. And now they have fiscal sustainability for 40-plus years.
Is it a fact that we're not likely to be the reserve currency much longer? At the time when President Reagan was in office, and the reference is made in that quote, which may or may not be accurate, about President Reagan proving deficits don't matter, there really was no alternative reserve currency. If you were OPEC, if you were what was then a thriving Japanese economy, you would invest your surplus in dollars and dollar-denominated securities because that was it. Today you can do it in euros. And I wonder if the fact that the euros is an alternative investment for a reserve currency puts a real fast time clock on how we can continue to borrow from these other countries. Bill?
I think it does, and I think we already addressed that if foreigners get allergic in any way to dollar-denominated assets, we're in big trouble. And don't forget that right now oil is priced in dollars. And if that were to change and they were to price it in euros, then we would just be beginning to see the problem with oil prices in the United States. I mean, the expense would be enormous for us.
So, Allison.
Well, I agree with that. I would just say, though, that the United States is still one of the best investments that you can make. That's why we're able to attract a lot of capital. But if we don't get our fiscal house in order, and this is what we're all saying here, that's not going to be the case any longer.
Among the solutions I've given you that have been brought forward, one I was hesitant even to bring forward, but I will for the sake of getting a predictable response. How about repudiating the debt?
No way.
Okay.
No way.
Dave says no way. Okay. Allison?
I say no way. You know, I'm from California. I worked in the County of Orange, and I was there when we had the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of the country. And they talked about that as one of the answers. Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And Dave has more to add.
Well, keep in mind, you said before, Tom, that we have $9 trillion in debt, of which about half of that is debt held by the public. The problem's not the $9 trillion. The problem is the $41 trillion in unfunded promises, and you could repudiate the debt, which makes no sense, and you wouldn't touch that $41 trillion at all.
The suggestion was brought forward that maybe we should look at our political process, that it's not enough to do the good work that you're doing, but that we need some substantial reforms in our political process. Term limits are put forward as a suggestion. I'm going to start with Bob on this one as an observer of Capitol Hill and legislatures as well, and move to other members of the panel. But if necessary, you can ask me because I've been both a legislator and a congressman. Do term limits bring into office a person a little bit more sensitive to these issues or not?
I don't think it necessarily does. I wouldn't look to that as a solution to these problems, although Court Chair Warren Rudman sometimes jokes that the way to do this is have a president elected on a pledge not to run for reelection and have a two-year term or something. And then everybody in Congress agrees that they're going to resign at the end of the term when they solve this problem, and that's the only way you can get it done. That's not realistic, but it's a sort of a facetious suggestion. But I think basically if we talk about some process things, one way to do that that might have a similar effect is a commission, and there are proposals for commissions out there, but it can't be a paper tiger commission. It would have to have, because there have been plenty of those, there has to have political buy-in by both sides, and it has to have some guarantee that whatever the commission came up with would be put to a vote in the Congress. Could be amended, but it should be debated. If there was something like that could provide bipartisan cover, that might be a way to get at this without going through the process of amending the Constitution for term limits.
Bob, I'll add to your observation that that's how we got base closing. It was very difficult to close the superfluous bases at the end of the Cold War because the congressperson in whose district the base resided would be viewed as ineffective if that was the one that was closed. So a commission was established. The commission made recommendations of the bases that had to be closed, and then it was put to a Congress all or nothing, yes or no, no amendments. And we actually were therefore able to close some bases. Similarly, the 1983 Greenspan Commission reform on Social Security was done in that way. The particular question, though, was for term limits, and so I'll ask if there's any other member of the panel wishes to speak on that. If not, we'll go to another suggestion. Yes, Dave.
I don't think it's a first resort. I think you need campaign finance reform, more of that. You also need to look at redistricting because the way that we go about redistricting right now causes not only a partisan problem but an ideological divide, which is a bigger problem than the partisan problem. I think if you can't solve it through these others, then you may have to think about term limits. But if you do term limits, the terms have to be long enough that you get some continuity and seasoning. I mean, you know, in California, your terms aren't long enough. I mean, my view is you wouldn't want to make it shorter than 12 years.
We're actually going to be discussing a ballot initiative to change the term limits in California coming up right now. Moving to other possible solutions, the political will for reduction in spending is very hard to find. The political will to increase taxes is very hard to find. It's not surprising, therefore, that we get into this difficulty. What can we see in a realistic sense on the horizon to induce candidates to run and to elect them who are willing to make those choices? Is there anything a member of the panel can suggest? This, by the way, came from over five members of the audience.
Well, I would say if a crowd this size showed up at town hall meetings or campaign events and kept demanding one after the other answers to how candidates would address these questions, that's the way you do it. I mean, each of you can write to a congressman, each of you can write to two United States senators, and each of you can write to a president. And so the power really is with the people in this, if the people choose to exercise it. Ultimately, that's what's going to have to happen, I think. And that's why we're out on this fiscal wake-up tour.
Allison?
Yeah, and just to build on that, you know, right now, members of Congress, it is the third rail of politics for them to talk about this. And what we're trying to do is to change the dynamic so that they feel that they have permission to talk about it and then move beyond that to feel that they have a mandate to talk about it. They can't get out of that town hall or campaign meeting without telling you, here are the three things that I would do, and I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to take a bunch of stuff off the table either. Those are the things, and this is how you can help to build that mandate.
I'm going to make one quick suggestion of my own on this, and that is I really can't tell you how strong the effect is of having a flyer sent out right before an election with a rating as to how good your incumbent's record has been. And we get those from every group that wants spending in a particular area. What's missing is from a fiscally responsible budget deficit. If you would rate the members of Congress, the National Taxpayers Coalition does that, but then put out a flyer of that nature right before an election, it might help balance the tables a bit. A question I'm going to read precisely so that I don't do unfairness to it. Your audience today appears to be primarily socioeconomically homogeneous and an aging group who have the time and means to hear your presentation. That certainly includes me. How are you getting this message out to younger generations from a broad range of education and cultures?
We're trying to look at a number of different communication mechanisms. I mean, for example, I was on the Stephen Colbert Show, which is where, you know, that and Jon Stewart is where young people get their news. We're also looking to try to leverage the Internet as well. I know I just found out within the last 24 hours there's evidently quite a bit on YouTube that I wasn't aware of that I'll have to go and take a look at. There is a documentary, just like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, there's a documentary being done on this topic that's going to be released next spring. There are a number of things that are going on right now. You do need to get young people and you need to get the business community because they're the two groups that need to be more engaged than they are right now.
Let me just say, most of our fiscal wake-up tour, this is Bob Bixby, most of our fiscal wake-up tour events are held on college campuses. We are targeting younger audiences because this affects them most, and it's primarily a leadership challenge for our future leaders. So today's audience, given the description of it, is perhaps not typical of our audiences because we try to get a younger audience, and we're like I say, most of our events are held at college campuses.
Allison?
Yeah, we also always try and meet with business leaders because they have not been as engaged in this issue as they should be. We had a great forum last night with some business leaders, and we do that all across the country to get them fully engaged. So we really are trying to reach out to a number of different key audiences.
Let me also say that your willingness to do this is tremendous. I think all four of you are patriots, and the country owes you a debt of gratitude for doing this. The last question now, which is going to each of you, will consume the remaining time that we have. It is the most fun and the most dangerous. It is, which of the presidential candidates do you believe is most responsive to these issues? This question was asked more than any of the others that was submitted this afternoon. So by a random choice which I'm unable to describe, I'm going to start with Allison.
Oh, that's so unfair.
It's so unfair.
I don't think any of them are talking about it. I think I just don't think you maybe hear a few remarks here and there. I mean, Fred Thompson has said that he was going to make it a priority. I have no idea what that means. Okay, this is where let's have some tough talk. What do you mean by that? It sounds okay. I want to know what you mean by that. I'm a little concerned that there's a candidate or two who's starting to take things off the table. It's not the direction that I want to go. So I don't have an answer because I'm not getting any answers.
Dave Walker, I know you're a government employee.
Well, yeah, but I'm independent, and I'm not going to do anything that would be an implicit endorsement of anybody. I mean, the bottom line is this. We need to make sure that the next president of the United States, whomever that is, male, female, Republican, Democrat, independent, makes fiscal responsibility and intergenerational equity one of their top three priorities. If they do, we can turn this around. If they don't, we're in trouble. And I think anybody who takes things off the table is making a huge mistake. You've got to have all the options available, and you've got to be able to use the bully pulpit, the power of the White House, to be able to go directly to the people, to work on a bipartisan basis to start dealing with this. That's what you need to look for.
Bill Sawhill.
I'm afraid I have to say none of the above as well. And the most important, we don't know enough yet. Nobody's talking about this. The most important thing, as my colleagues have said, is that candidates not take things off the table. We heard a rumor when we were in Las Vegas that Senator Clinton, for example, has said, I'll never cut your Social Security benefits. I have not double-checked, so I don't want to start a rumor here about whether she actually said that, but that's exactly the kind of statement that we don't need. We also don't need, and there have been some Republican candidates who've said, I'm going to cut your taxes or I'm never going to raise your taxes, which is equally bad. So this is something we're going to have to watch, and we hope all of you will watch as well.
And Bob Bixby.
I've read some very encouraging statements from presidential candidates on the importance of generational responsibility, and I can't decide between George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. I have seen nothing similar from the current crop of presidential candidates.
It's been a few years. Okay.
Well, as are any of them concerned? Yes, the answer is, but the ones who are most concerned are all dead. And that's the problem.
Dave's going to.
Yeah, let me. My family came to this country in 1680s. I live on property that George Washington used to own. George Washington said a long time ago, we should avoid ungenerously throwing upon posterity the burden that we ourselves ought to bear. He was right then. He's right now. And it's about time we got some politicians on both sides of the aisle that'll start following his words.
What a way to end. What a way to end. Eloquently said and powerfully delivered. We want to thank our panel for all they're doing for our country, particularly for coming to our beautiful city of San Francisco this afternoon. David Walker, Comptroller General of the United States, Bell Sawhill, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution, Allison Fraser of the Heritage Foundation, and Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. We also thank our audience, those of you who came out today, and those of you who are listening on the radio. Today's program has been part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability and was presented in association with the New California Network. I'm Tom Campbell, the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business, University of California, Berkeley. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.